Om Bharataya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kritithaṁ Purāna Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavad Varshini. So we're on chapter 9, verse 21. We did the verse 21 last time, but not so thoroughly, right? I'm going to finish and say a little bit more about that. Can I have extra books? You guys can share. Tetam bhuktva sarvalokam vishalam. Tetam bhuktva sarvalokam vishalam. Kshine punye marchalokam vishanti. Kshine punye marchalokam vishanti. Evam trayi dharmam anuprapannaha. Evam trayi dharmam anuprapannaha. Gatagatam kama kama labante. Gatagatam kama kama labante. Te tam bhuktva swarga lokam vishalam. Kshine punye martya lokam vishanti. Evam trayi dharmam anuprapannaha gata agatam gata agatam kama kamaha labante. Remember in the previous verse 20, it's really talking about the dharmis who are contained within the Vedic culture, who do all of the karmas, all of the rituals, they follow dharma, they do the whatever the duties are that are enjoined upon them within their particular... They do the duties that are enjoined upon them within their particular sthana or stage in life. So they're dharmis, but they're also kama-kamaha. Kama-kamaha means people who have desires for given desired objects. And when a person the word kama can mean a desire, mean a person who has a desire, and it can be mean the desired object. So if you say kama kamaha, that's in the nominative plural, it means those people who have desires, they're desirers of kama. They're desirers, they're kamis, they're desirers of desire. But here the desire, the kama in that form means the desired object. So those people who are held within the Vedic culture, who are dharmis, who are performing the Vedic rituals and those things that are enjoined upon them, at the same time, they're not performing those, they're performing those karmas in order to really gain what we call the three of the four purusharthas. The four purusharthas. Purushartha means a purushartha is something which is desired by a human being. The four major purusharthas, sometimes they say the goal of a human being. Four major goals. That means four things that just humans in general desire, seek for, strive for. For their own sense of completion, for their own sense of well-being. The first one is called artha. Artha means all humans strive to have security. You know, like a nice home, a good family, enough money in the bank, you know, health insurance, all of the things that are necessary for us to have, kind of to provide relative security. That's artha. Kama is the second one. Kama means everyone, once the artha is taken care of, is a desire for pleasures, for enjoyments, of the various kinds. People have different desires for, you know, some people like to go to Las Vegas. And other people would like to go camping. There's all kinds of desires. Some people like to have computers, whatever it is. People have desires for things that are pleasurable. Those are the kamas. They have a desire for pleasure. The third one is called dharma itself. So we have artha, kama, and then dharma. Dharma is people have a desire to do what is right, to do what is charitable, to do the things that are enjoined upon you in your particular stage of life, so that you can go to heaven instead of hell, so that you can get a better next birth. You know, in the East, they believe, you know, take for granted actually the transmigration of the soul, and so when this body dies, I would like to experience positive lokas or have positive states of experience, and to take a better next birth than to have negative lokas, negative states of experience, and have a worse less birth, a worse next birth. And so dharma is actually very important if you see your life as something that continues on, life, birth after birth after birth after birth. Not only do you want to enjoy yourself in this life, you also want to enjoy yourself in the next life. And so an average Hindu sees way into the future. So this life protects me. No, but seriously, very seriously, we do dharma just for an immediate shanti, the immediate shanti that will give in this life, but it also the punya and the papa that's accrued by the subtle effects of your actions and go kind of into the mix for determining your next life. That's also very important. So these three, artha, kama, and dharma, a dharmi, you know, a samsari who is a dharmi, will work for. And contained within the Vedic culture, there's many devatas, many rituals that can be done. There are certain things that are enjoined upon you to do. And those things being done appropriately, that person will enjoy planes of existence in the next after this death, and then take a good come back again, right? They're going to come back, right? Because that kartritvam, that doership is still there. They're going to come back again. But before they come back, they will have enjoyed some heavenly experiences in the heavenly world, and then they'll come back with a decent body for the next round here. Okay, so that's what kind of within the Vedic containing myth, like in the Western containing myth, people think, well, you know, I have to do what is right and try to lead a good life here so that I can go to heaven and not go to hell. And so we all have this type of kind of religious, you know, container that hold people in terms of what happens to you after death. So this is like that. Very much like that. And so here it says, it goes, this is the verse that we did last time, most of it. It goes into more detail. It says, so such people who are performing or living a Vedic life, but desiring to enjoy the fruits of those rituals here itself in the form of punya, they having enjoyed, so te tam bhuktva swargalokam vishalam, they having enjoyed this vast expanse of swargaloka, having gone to some heaven world, the problem is that then having enjoyed it, shine punye, when their punya runs out, the punya that caused them to go to that, allowed them to go to that world, then they marchalokam vishanti, they return to this world, which is marchalokam, where everybody in this world is mortal, is subject to birth and death. So having enjoyed the punya, they will go to a swargaloka. In swargaloka, there's no death or old age. But when that punya runs out, then that stay there is gone. And they'll find themselves being reborn here in this loka. So it says, so those people, having followed having followed in this manner, the manner that we've looked at in this verse and the previous verse, having followed the threefold Dharma, which means that the three Vedas, especially the Rig, Yajur, and Sama Veda, having followed, you know, that Vedic culture as enjoined by the three Vedas, having followed that in the manner that's been told, then these kama-kamahas, these people who are going after their desires and seeking the blessings of the devatas and the various rituals and all of the things that they do, they, having done all of that in order to get these rewards, you know, in heavenly worlds and better next birth, then what happens? Those people obtain in the end what they call gata agata. Gata means they go and they come. Coming and going, coming and going. Gata means they go to the, they attain this state of gatam, means they will leave here. They will leave here, and then what will happen? Agatam. They'll come back. So rebirth, right? Coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. And that's what we call samsara. Samsara means that samyak sadaha, the experience within this loka, within any loka, within the whole manifest creation, is an experience of continual change. So on every level of the creation, of the whole manifest creation, all that exists within duality, there is constant coming and going. On a microscopic level, on just the level of our experience of the world, and the level of the birth and death of the body, there's continual birth and death. And so that is our state. As long as the jiva is here, our state is one of continual coming and going, because there's nothing within the creation that's free of that. So there's nothing in the creation on any level that's free of birth and death. Birth and death really is the same thing as change. Any moment of change is the death of the prior moment and the birth of the next moment. And so if you look at birth and change like that, you know, in order, there is, in fact, if you were to look at change, whether you say change, which is the death of the prior moment and the birth of the coming moment, it's impossible to find a moment that's free of birth and death. If you analyze change, any moment of change, change takes place in time, right? Change takes place in time. If you were to get beyond change, you have to get beyond time. And the problem with time is that time is linear, right? And if time is linear, it's infinitely divisible. Right? Say if I have a moment in time, and that we say it's linear because for there to be a moment in time, the time starts at one point and then it moves to the next point. So here's our little chunk of time right there, or a moment of time. But this moment of time can be divided, and then now we have two moments of time, right? And then those two moments can themselves be divided, you know? And as long as there is time, that moment of time is divisible, right? As long as the time is there. The only time that time is not divisible is when there's time that is not there, which would be timeless, right? But that timelessness doesn't exist in the creation. Let's put it this way, put it like this. Timelessness does not exist within time. Do you see how that is? Because if you're within time, it's linear. If it's linear, it's divisible. And so timelessness doesn't exist within time. And so what that means that in this creation, there is nothing but birth and death, or nothing but change. Change is the, you know, the death of the prior moment and the birth of the next moment. But you can't find that moment, because that moment, whatever it is divisible. So there's kind of an infinite regress there. So we're kind of in an odd situation in reference to the creation. It's such an odd situation that you'd think there's no possibility even for any type of an experience here, because it's already gone. But the situation, there's a different level to that situation, and that different level has to do with one who's present to the time itself. the one who's aware of time. So what is actually held within time, right, is subject to continual birth and death on every level. But that which is aware of time, right, is not bound by time. The one that illumines time is not bound by time. So let me give you an example of that. If I'm aware of change, if I'm aware of something that is changing, right, the one who is aware of it isn't subject to that, to the change. Right? If you're aware of change, something that's changing, you yourself aren't subject to that change. And the reason is that if you were subject to it, then you would no longer be aware of it, right? You would have already gone mm-hmm. with a change. So if you're aware of the change, you're there before, during, and after the change. That means you're not subject to change of whatever it is you're aware of. You see how that is? If you illumine it, the thing is changing, the moment has changed, but you've been there before, during, and after. So you're free of that change. So in reference to what you objectify, the one who is the awareful component of the objectification is free of the objectification. The objectification is bound by time. The one who's objectifying it is not. Right? And so say, for instance, if I'm objectifying all of you, you know, as I'm sitting here looking at you, and you're also, you know, objectifying whatever is in front of you, in reference to what you're objectifying is changing, and you're witness to the change. Like, for instance, if I go from here to here with my hand, right, nothing's happened to you. My hand has changed, the place has changed, everything has changed, you know, if I go like that, whatever motion is there. You know, you're aware of that, and the one who's aware of it outlasts that, is not touched by that change. Right? Because you're illumining it, doesn't touch you at all. But you can say, so that's just on one very kind of gross level, you can see that subject-object relationship, and I watch all of this change, but I'm not bound by the change. But then I can say, yeah, but the one who's witnessing this change, these changes, is itself changing at another rate. See what I mean? But it's not subject to the change that's being witnessed, but it itself is subject to change. Mm. Like my eyes, for instance, are subject to over time dimming, that type of thing. But then I objectify my eyes with my mind. And so my mind is not subject to the change that I'm illumining with my eye. I'm illumining the change that my eyes go through. But because I can illumine that change, I'm not subject to the change. I'm aware of the change. See what I mean? So that change is taking place, but I illumine the change, I'm free of the change that's taking place. But then I can say, yeah, but this mind that's always changing, is always changing itself. The mind which is able to illumine the eyes that are changing, this mind itself is changing. Right? And so it's just at a different order of change. It's like something which is changing is aware of something that's changing. But what about when you illumine the mind? So you can say, yes, the mind is changing, but the awareness that's illumining the mind, that's not changing, or it wouldn't be aware of, you know, the changing mind. So once you go back far enough, you get to the point of having the awareness is now objectifying everything that is objectifiable within the creation. Like, say, for you from your individual standpoint, your body is objectifiable and its changes. Your sense organs are objectifiable and their changes. Your mind is objectifiable and its changes. The I thought is objectifiable and its changes, right? The roles that you play in life are objectifiable and their changes. The space and time itself is objectifiable and their changes. But what about the awareness itself? Is that objectifiable? It is, but is it objectifiable? The conscious being. In the end, you're left with a conscious being that is, but it's not objectifiable. If it's objectifiable, right, then you have a subject-object relationship with it. And if you have a subject-object relationship, then that thing, that awareness also is existing in time, subject to the same problem of being part of the universe and then subject to continual change. And so awareness is aware of changing awareness. But that isn't our situation. Awareness is awareness, but it's not aware of awareness as an object within the creation. Like, I can't say, well, look at this awareness, watch how it changes. Look at this body, look at how it changes. Yes, I can do that. Look at my sense organs, look at how they change. Yes, I can do that. Look at my mind, look at how it changes. My emotions, look at how they change. Yes, I can do that. Yeah. Look at all of you, look at how you change. Look at the creation, look at how it changed. We can do that. But now, after I've objectified all of that, and I'll say, now I'm just left with awareness, you know, because of which all of these things are objectified. Now can I say, oh, look at this awareness, look at how it changes. And what am I looking at? Look at awareness, look at how it changes. There's no awareness to look at, there's only an awareness to be. Right? There's no objectification. And so when there's no objectification, then where is the time-space coordinates that allow awareness itself to be a changing entity? And so, if your identity, if your point of identity is with your body or your mind or your sense organs, then you have what we call that, you know, doership. You are an individual, you are a jiva within the creation. And then you yourself, everything about you is subject to change. That's true. Everything in the body, the mind, the sense organs is subject to change. Your mind, the states of mind are subject to change. You're in a position of having to gain things or having to lose things, which we'll see we call yogic shema. We need to gain things and we have to protect ourselves from losing things. You know, I have to put myself in situations where the environment is conducive to my happiness, where the environment is something that can give me a sense of security, you know, where I gain punya and papa, and where I gain punya and avoid papa, you know, where my actions are dharmic, so they accrue subtle results of my actions, which will manifest in positive situations for me, so that I can be in a safe situation, or that I can have my desires can be fulfilled. You know, I can live and have a nice home instead of, you know, being destitute and all of these things that people fear. And so that's the situation. That's the situation of being a jiva. But so the jiva, the jiva is always in relationship to God in terms of a divine power who will help me, a divine power even in the form of devatas that we can evoke through rituals, or even if I'm praying to Ishwar, the Lord, I'm praying to Bhagawan to help me, you know, to help me get the things that I need in order to be happy, to protect me, to protect my body, to give me health, or to give me a good mind, to give me viveka, you know, to even take me to a teacher so that I can gain knowledge, all of these things. I'm still praying from the standpoint of a jiva who needs to protect myself within this ever-changing creation. So I'll evoke the Lord for that. You know, either take me to a better loka or give me a better body, you know, or protect all of my desired objects and get rid of all of the things that I don't desire. That's the situation. So such a person is in a continual state of coming and going. How to get out of that state, really, is to how to get out of that state is to discover the discover the self is already out of that state. That's what has to happen, because from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, being a jiva within the world, there actually is no getting out of that state, because the very nature of the upadis, of the body, the mind, the sense organs, and the world are in that state by their very nature. And so, if that is who you are, if what makes you you is these entities, these upadis, which themselves are bound by endless change, infinitely divisible moments of change, there's no way to get out of that. Because that is the nature of the world, right? And so if that is the your nature, and if that is the nature of the world, your nature means you are your body, mind, sense organs, which themselves are subject by their nature to perpetual change. And these upadis, this body, which is body, mind, sense organs, which is subject to that perpetual change, like it or not, you know, is living in a world which by its nature is subject to infinitely divisible perpetual change, then what can you do is only try to place yourself in this world in such a way that you will be enjoying the positive side of the spectrum more than the negative side of the spectrum for a longer period of time. And you can do that by evoking the grace of God, by living a dharmic life to the best of your ability, you know, getting Bhagavan's grace, doing prayers, all of the things that you can possibly do in order to evoke the benign side of the ever-changing creation. What else are you going to do? There is no release other than dharma. And that dharma, the following dharma, is a practice. Dharma is something that needs to be done. Dharma belongs to the karta, to the one who is the doer, the jiva. You know, dharma involves doing. You don't just look at dharma. Dharma is how you relate in the world. You know, and there's certain laws in the creation, like the golden rule, for instance, you know, that give you some protection. Dharma gives protection. You know? And it gives protection to that which needs to be protected. That's what, you know. Dharma gives you relative protection of something which needs protection. There's no liberation in something which needs to be protected. Right? How can you relax? Where's the relaxation, you know? The relaxation, it's not a matter of relaxation, it's a matter of being alert, you know, and doing what is to be done to the best of your ability to ward off the papa. That's what it amounts to. And so Bhagavan says here, remember we're talking here about dharmis. We're talking about dharmis who are living a dharmic life as they should, following the Vedas, the three Vedas. Those people live a life of gata-gatam, continual coming and going. And so as opposed to those people, then let's do this next verse. It goes, Ananyas chintayanto man, ye janah pariyupasate, ye janah pariyupasate, teshan nityabhiyuktanam, Teshan nityabhiyuktanam yogakshema vahamyaham, yogakshema vahamyaham, ananyaha chintayantaha mam, ye janaha pariyupasate, teshan nityabhiyuktanam yogakshema vahamyaham. So here, how Shankara introduces this verse, he says, ye punaha nishkamaha samyak darshinaha. He says, on the other hand, those who are samyak darshinaha, those who have knowledge, means they're darshan, samyak darshinaha means those whose vision is clear, those who see things as they are, samyak darshinaha, those who have knowledge, who are nishkamaha, those people are free of kama. They're free of desire. So we'll look into that in a minute. So who are those people? He says, those people who are ananyaha chintayantaha, they're people who are not seeing me as another. Ananyaha means there is no other. They don't see me as another. In other words, another person that I'm one person and the Lord is there, that I need to invoke the Lord in order to, you know, fulfill my desires. So those people who... Jimmy, what's the matter? It's okay. You can come. Ananyaha chintiyantaha mam ye janaha pariyupasate. He says, there's two ways of taking this. You can take it as the jnani, the one who has knowledge, and you can take it as the mumukshu, the one who is seeking knowledge. Ananya means ananyaha. There is no other. So those, for those who are pariyupasate, those who are recognizing me, pariyupasate means two things also. Those who are recognizing me or those who are seeking me. If we take it as the jnani, he says, those people who are recognizing me, and when they say that pariyupasate, pari means everywhere. Pari means, when you have pari as an upasarga, as a preposition to a verb or noun, it means that which goes all of the way around. And so say, if I'm seeing you from all directions. There's no way that I'm not seeing you. Wherever I look, I'm seeing you. In fact, Swamiji quotes a verse, a couple of beautiful verses. One verse goes like this. It's, wherever I look, you are there. Talking about Ishwara. Wherever I look, you are there. And therefore, I'm always in samadhi. Right? Even in reference to the ahankara. Whatever is there, whatever vritti is there, whatever is experience is there, is you. Is Bhagavan. Which is true. The whole creation is Ishwara. Right? And so the awareness illumines, whatever is being illumined in this creation is Bhagavan, is Ishwara. And so whatever falls in my mind, whatever that is there in my mind, that is Ishwara. And so, if that is Ishwara, then the awareful being that I am is Brahman, is awareness, and the vritti is Ishwara, right? And so, wherever my mind falls, there is Ishwara, and therefore I'm always in samadhi. So that's why, you know, in the Aparokshana Bhuti, that one Prakarna Granta that Shankara teaches in the end section of that, he makes fun of meditation, but only to make a point. He says, you know, when am I not meditating? How can you get out of meditation? What is meditation? Do you have to be sitting to be meditating? Are you not meditating when you're standing or when you're walking? Because where is there not Ishwara? So where is there not you? And what experience are you having that is not you for you to meditate on? What if you... How can you meditate? Because there's no place to go that is not you. And actually, that is the Jivan Mukta. The Jivan Mukta is the one who recognizes, I am Ishwara. Right? It's not that I'm a jiva experiencing Ishwara. It's that I am Ishwara. The conscious being that I am, the tattvamasi, you are that. The conscious being that you are is the conscious being which Ishwara is. There is no experience in the creation. The whole creation is an infinite manifest knowledge. That includes the infinite manifest knowledge, the total maya upadhi. So awareness plus the total maya upadhi is Ishwara. And this body, mind, sense organs, even the ahankara, every part of it, is part of Ishwara. And so there is no experience that you can have that is an Ishwara. There's no law outside, and there are no laws if you say, look at Ishwara, the whole manifestation of the creation and the infinite network of laws that make up this manifest order. This body, mind, sense organs is not outside of that infinite network of laws. It's not like there's Ishwara and then you've walked into it. It's like the body, mind, sense organs are as much a part of Ishwara as everything else. You can't get outside of it. And so therefore, every experience that you have is Ishwara. Well, what if you're a bhakta? Jnani can't but really be a bhakta, you know? And so if you are a bhakta, if you recognize, by bhakta I mean you recognize that this is Ishwara, you know, then what is your relationship to these experiences that you're having? It's one of this ascharyavat. You know, they say, ascharyavat, ascharya, danyoham, danyoham, danyoham. What a blessing, what a blessing, what a wonder. You know, what a wonder this is. Yeah, in Panchadashi, in the last section of chapter 7, so for those of you that went through that with us, the last 15 verses of chapter 7 in Pachadashi is this Danyoham, Danyoham, Danyoham. That's why Danya wanted her name to be changed to Danya. So Danyoham, Danyoham, what a wonder, what a wonder. Ascharya, what an Ascharya. Ascharya means a wonder. Danya means what a blessing, you know. I'm so blessed. If I say Danyoham, I'm so blessed, I'm so blessed. Because all of this experience that you're having is viewed as Ishwara, right? The conscious being that you are is Ishwara. The manifest creation that you experience is Ishwara. And so where is there room really for the ahankara there? So the ahankara, in a sense, becomes really what we call a dugda bija, like a burnt seed. It doesn't have any capacity to cause you trouble, because it itself also is Ishwara. Right, so here he's saying the one who recognizes me, ananya chintayaha, not recognizing another, not seeing otherness between you and me, between myself and Ishwara, but only not seeing another there, seeing only Ishwara. So for such people, you know, who see, are only seeing me, for them, tesham nitya yuktan abhiyuktanam, for such people who are always simply united in me, like a part is united to the whole, like a wave is united to the ocean, right? Held together by the one water. For those who see, when you're looking out, you see that this is all Ishwara, and this body, mind, sense organs is totally part of Ishwara. There's not me and Ishwara. It's that this whole thing, clear as into from the stand, even into the ahankara itself, that this whole thing is Ishwara. So for those people who only see that, he says, I take care of their yoga kshema. So now there's some couple of interesting things here. Yoga means, but when we have these two terms, yoga kshema, yoga means those things which I need, those things that I desire, or those things that I need. And kshema means those things that I need to protect. Say you need something, now, so you have it now, you need to get something, and so now you get it. But now you have it. Now that you have it, you have to protect it. So yoga is the need to acquire, and kshema is the need to protect what I've acquired. So the fulfillment of a desire and then the protecting of that thing, that's the yoga kshema. And so here, for the mumukshu or for the jnani, what the mumukshu is seeking is Ishwara, is self-knowledge, right? I'm not seeking anymore that let me go to this swargaloka, or let me get this new car. If I could just have the new car, I'd be happy. That type of ajnanam isn't that type. That's aviveka. That aviveka is no longer there, because I've had too many experiences where I've gotten what I was seeking, and it's nice for a moment, but then now I need something else. Right? I've seen through that. So mamukshu is a person who is no longer really seeking these things, but is only seeking Ishwara. The jnani is the one who was a mumukshu and now has that. Seeking Ishwara means I'm the whole, right? Seeking self-knowledge. And so for such a person, now their mind is not set on fulfilling yoga kshema anymore. And so then Bhagavan says, that's all right, I'll take care of that. I fulfill all the yoga kshema. You don't need to worry about that. And in fact, nobody needs to really worry about it, because the yoga kshema is something that's fulfilled anyway by the prarabdha karma. You know? The prarabdha karma, the karmas that caused you to come into this birth, will take you all the way through. And who is the prarabdha karma? Is Ishwara, right? Ishwara is the prarabdha karma. Ishwara, your life, what is your life? Ishwara, you know? And your life is part of the unfoldment of the whole. You know, if sometimes to really understand this, just think of a dream. When you have a dream at night, your life, the character that you may be, the characters that are in the dream, their life, all of their experiences, all of their interrelationships are part of the story of the dream. Right? They don't lie outside of the dream story. They're part and parcel of the whole story of the dream. But each one of them can think, you know, I am creating this story, and the story depends upon me. Whereas actually, the story is holding them. And so from the standpoint of a jnani, really this life is looked at, is experienced as part of Ishwara's story. And Ishwara is the one who's taking care of the yoga kshema. And for a jnani or for a mumukshu, that's no problem at all. Because, you know, it's kind of like the animal cracker story. You know, the animal crackers, they're all made of graham cracker. You know, the little animal cracker boxes full of graham crackers, elephant graham crackers, and, you know, horse graham crackers and dog graham crackers, all kinds of different, you know, animal graham crackers. And so a child may only want the horse graham cracker, not the elephant or the giraffe, only the horse. Yeah. And another one wants, you know, the doggy graham cracker or the cat graham cracker, not the other. But somebody who just likes graham crackers, you know, they can have the horse graham cracker, or they can have the elephant graham cracker or the cat graham cracker. It makes no difference at all. Yeah? Because they've realized the graham crackerness of it, right? That's a jnani. So for a jnani, you know, whether I have this situation, this colorful, you know, kaleidoscope, this design here, or this design here, or this design here, or this situation here, or this situation here, it's all nothing but Bhagavan, it's all nothing but Ishwara, and I am the self of the whole thing. So that's a jnani. And so for such a person, this life, as opposed to this life, or this life, or this life, or this life, this life is fine. This is awareness. This life is awareness in its truth. This life is awareness in its truth. This situation is awareness in its truth. This situation is awareness in its truth. The awareness never changes. And so if my commitment is what I'm seeing is the awareness, is Ishwara, if that's what I'm seeing, then let Ishwara, whatever is Ishwara is doing, that's my yoga kshema. That is it. That is fine with me because it's Bhagavan. Yeah. And it's just Bhagavan in another colorful, situation. The freedom also in that, though, is that colorful situation, you know, has for its truth, you know, one changeless being. And that one changeless being is whole and complete. So it's not like Ishwara is going through all kinds of modifications. Ishwara yourself is always the same, you know, with this infinite complexity that we call Maya, that comes and goes without changing, you know, without changing yourself. And so when you recognize that, right, then Bhagavan says, I take care of all your yoga kshema, because what is going on here is me. What is going on here is me. I take care of the whole thing. You don't have to worry about it. But if you're coming from the drishti, if you're coming from the standpoint of a jiva, you know, one of these changing molecules in the situation, then, you know, you're subject to, you have to protect yourself.
Mm. You're suffering.
Yeah, you have to protect yourself. You have to try to protect yourself. And it's just human nature, you know, and try to achieve out of this, you know, the horse graham cracker instead of the dog graham cracker. I would actually like to have horse graham crackers, dog graham crackers, and cat graham crackers. Somebody else might want elephant graham crackers. No. It's much better just to love graham crackers. Just to love the graham cracker and forget about the nama rupa. When that's the case, then Bhagavan says, I take care of all the yogic shame, and there's no problem whatsoever. That aham bahami means I protect, I take care of it. I take care of their yoga kshema. Those who are nitya abhiyuktanam, those who are not, who are always united with me. They never drop out to take themselves as a jiva. That jivatvam they're not subject to. So as they're subject to jivatvam, then that abhiyuktanam isn't there anymore. And it's all of a sudden, I need this. But when they as they see themselves only as me, then there's no problem at all. So let's let me stop there. Let's just take a minute. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
To see all of this as Ishvara, or how should you approach that?
I think it's really just through knowledge, through more and more understanding. And the thing that actually makes you kind of drop out of that vision is really lack of vairagya. Vairagya and knowledge. Vairagya means that dispassion, you know, viveka, vairagya, shimadana, those. So vairagya is I like the example of helium balloons. Helium balloons for a child, you know, when you've had your helium balloon, carrying it around. You ever get those when you're little, you know, these helium balloons? Undoubtedly, it either gets popped or you let it go. And for a child, that is an issue. You know? But for an adult, it isn't. It's fun while you have it, and it's fine when you don't. I mean, really fine. You know? It's a non-issue. You can enjoy it when it's there, and it's fine when it's not. That's vairagya. Vairagya isn't this, you know, don't get it near me because I might want it. So vairagya is not negative, right? It's just that I can be with this while it's here, and I can be free with it also when it's not here, without myself becoming hurt or sad. So that vairagya needs to mature. Once you come to this knowledge, you will have a certain degree of vairagya because you've realized that the world gives moments of happiness, but you cannot count on it for anything lasting. You come to that realization.
Mm.
And so you, just because that's the fact, that's the nature of the world. And so then you realize that what you're seeking is something that is more stable than that. and that the world by its nature can't provide it. And so then you become a seeker. But when you recognize yourself, then you have actually found that which is really the source of wholeness and doesn't come and go. Right? And so when you discover that, then vairagya becomes natural. Right? Because otherwise it's kind of like, well, I myself am not whole and complete, but I certainly can't get it from here. That's kind of, they call that the dark night of the soul, actually. You know? I want to be whole and complete, not just momentarily. I would like to just say, all is well with me, I'm fine. You know? And then that's the end of it. I don't have to worry about that anymore. But that's not something attainable in the creation, because the creation has no stable base like that, no stable platform. So you can't get that. So when you realize that creation cannot give it, but you don't know what can, that's a dark night of the soul, because you have no solution. Right? Because there is nothing in the creation. It's not your fault. It's not like you can say, well, if I only tried harder. No. There's no trying. It's not attainable. And so that vairagya is kind of a disappointing dark night of the soul vairagya. But that vairagya with knowledge becomes very natural, because in fact your nature is what in fact you were trying to get out of the world. And so once that projection is withdrawn, because you know the source of the wholeness you were seeking is really your own nature, then the mind resting in a self which is not subject to change and is full and whole and complete can experience the world which is continually changing, and not asking it to give me something which it can't give and never had, in fact. And so then, that vairagya is natural. But until one recognizes that thoroughly, the manas, you know, the emotional system, recognizes that thoroughly, it's always almost self-forgetfully, once you have knowledge, going out and saying, no, but I need this, or I need that, or I need the world to be like this, or I need people to treat me like this.
Then what do you see?
When you know and you understand, then you have your buddhi is something that can hold that behavior, you know, and bring it back. You can bring it back to your knowledge. You can bring that kind of erroneous habitual behavior back just through applying your knowledge to it. And then also there's other things like the inner child work that we do, the little complexes and kind of the child parts inside. Those are emotional complexes that need to be handled through, you know, love and care and friendship and all of that. But in the end, all of these different parts, including the little child parts, all of them will be brought back through knowledge. You know? Because really that's the only thing that in the end works. The inner child work or the inner dialogue, that's all very important for gaining a healthy, whole upadhi. That your psyche, that your mind, that your unconscious is functioning well and not injured. You know, I mean, we're all, as we grow up, we have sustained injuries and, you know, hurts and traumas. And so we need to know how to help those things on a relative level. And we have lots of ways to do that. You know, so that those parts, those hurt parts inside become well functioning again. But say everybody inside the little inner community that we have, everybody's doing well. Right? We're all doing well.
We're all happy.
But still, there's the relative problem, you know, that everything changes. It's not like we're all doing well and the world has stopped being a problem for us. It is a problem by its very nature until that problem is solved. And that problem is solved by recognizing the truth of yourself, what's actually going on. And so,
but the problems in the world don't vanish at that stage. I mean, there's still problems, right?
There are still problems, but you know, how do you hold the problems? Do you see the problems as something which are detrimental to your being, or do you see those problems as part of Ishvara? And so when you see them as part of Ishvara, you have some objectivity. You know, it's not like you don't try to help. You try to help and do your best within your situation, which is the tasks of you as an individual jiva are given to you moment by moment by moment by moment. And that's your arena, is to help, you know, to do what you can to make things better for yourself and others in your situation.
And then the yoga shama comes in at that time, or who's going to take care of everything?
The yoga shama, see, your life moment to moment to moment is being taken care of. In fact, this is kind of interesting thing. Your life is already here, and here it is right now. This is it. Okay, this is it. This is your life right here. Okay, now that moment's gone. This is your life right here. 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 It's never not that way. The life is here right now, and you are responding to it. So in fact, what Swamiji said so many times, I just do take care of what's right in front of me. And that's it. I do what's in front of me to be done. And once I heard him say it, and this is all just part of really recognizing, see, it's not your story. It's not like this is an inert creation and you're the little pocket of consciousness, you know, walking through kind of this threatening arena. This whole creation is you. This whole creation is a conscious being. You know, it's a story. This whole thing is a story, and you're part of the story. So you just play your part. Swamiji once said, you know, unless you can just live day by day, you can't be a Vedantin, really. It's kind of an interesting thing to say. In truth, we are all just living day by day, hour by hour, and dealing with the situations that are presented to us. You know, we may think that we're creating the situations. If anything, you're creating the attitudes of the situation. You know, but the situations are here to be responded to. And it's a really beautiful way to live your life because it works really well. You know, you can say, that doesn't mean that you don't plan for the future, but you plan for the future when the time is there to plan for the future. You know, like maybe planning for the future, it's time to make that deposit that I make every month. Okay, the time to make that monthly savings deposit has come now, so I make the savings deposit. Or whatever. What I'm saying is these times, it's time to, you know, the creation is going in such a way, my psyche is going in such a way, it's finally time to make a move. It's time to actually move to a new place. That's a huge thing. You can fantasize about that forever, but someday it may actually happen where the time has come where you make a move. And then the whole universe conspires along with you to make the move because that time has come. So if you start to just try to give up some of the kartritvam, the doership, as though you think that you're the creator of the whole thing. And then what's so kind of nice is that you're kind of giving that up and, gee, the whole thing is happening anyway.
Well, sort of like the image of being an actor that...
In a play.
Yeah, in a play, and you have your script, but then the director comes in the next morning and says, no, we changed everything and now it's going to be this way.
In Panchadashi, right, I think it's chapter 10. Panchadashi is a Prakarana Granta. It's a text that, you know, really expands upon the Upanishads. Panchadashi means 15 chapters. That's a famous text that Vedantins often study. So chapter 10 is just about this, being an actor on the stage.
Yeah. Now, I have a question about this also. I mean, the mind is pretty smart, you know, in terms of, because there was a lot of talking about surrender, right, this week. And so I've thought about that because, you know, it seems like your ability to surrender yourself to Ishwar, you know, is such a huge thing, you know. It's like, because it's like all the things that you were saying in a certain way require a certain letting go of the belief that you're still sitting in the driver's seat of this whole process. So in a way, the surrender seems like you just need to kind of trust Ishwar to really take over. And what I'm just saying is, because you were just saying, well, there's a time when you think about your life insurance maybe, right? So I kind of rationally can get that, but I can also see how I can use my mind to rationalize myself out of a deeper kind of process of surrendering, you know what I mean? So I can say, well, yeah, there's a place for life insurance, you know, in my life, and maybe I should really, you know, suddenly it just really hits me in my life, and I might think, well, then that's just what's happening, let me just respond to that. But it could also be that maybe I'm just, there's just an invitation here into a deeper kind of letting go of trying to control anything, because it's still, there's so many layers, it seems like, of how we take charge of this life, which we are fundamentally living in an illusion. That's the whole bubble of illusion that we live in, that we can take charge of it, you know? I mean, we can show up for it, like you said, mm-hmm. in any kind of dharmic way, as dharmic as possible, because that obviously seems like the most, makes the most sense. But I'm just saying, you know, it's an interesting thing. We're so conditioned with this mind, you know, to go like all the way with the surrender. I mean, that's a beautiful vision, you know, but how do you do that actually?
But that's the whole thing. Vairagya and surrender, all of these concepts, they're really only knowledge. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, the karta, the doer, is trying to do these things.
Right.
So there's really not trying involved. They're one and the same with knowledge. Like even vairagya and knowledge are the same. Surrender and knowledge are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Otherwise, there's somebody who's separate is trying to surrender. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so that there's nothing wrong with that. There's a certain attitude, and that kind of thing can be helpful. But in the end, the surrender is natural to knowledge. And not without it, even though it can be kind of a useful, prayerful attitude, that type of thing. Karma yoga. Even in the karma yoga attitude, there's still the bhakta, there's still the karta there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an attitude that can, toward Ishwara, that can be helpful, even though that dvaita is still there. But in the end, everything is Ishwara.
Sort of in the middle of the real thing.
Yes, but very close to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a very, 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 just very minimal shift that's required. That's why karma yoga is so powerful, that attitude. Yeah.
The last verse we've been talking about, I can see that this is valid for the jnani,
mm-hmm.
but it's more difficult for me to see that it's also valid for the mumukshu.
Yeah, for the mumukshu is the one, instead of recognizing, think of seeking. You know? Their whole vision is only towards seeking or recognizing the Lord, knowing the Lord, not toward getting their new car. But for the jnani, that is the reality. So one, it's the single-pointed seeking of that knowledge, and for the other, it's the recognition. When Shankara does that verse from Shankara's, it's only for the jnani. But others, including Swamiji, do it for the jnani as well as for the mumukshu.
Because for me, the mumukshu is a little bit kind of lost. Because, you know, he understands that, I mean, he doesn't get fulfillment through reaching any, you know, goals. That he understands this, so, and that's why he becomes a mumukshu, but he hasn't reached, you know, the...
Oh, I see. I think that when they're...
So for me, it always feels like... I mean, I see myself as a mumukshu, and I, I feel like being lost, you know, in this space between the old security, which doesn't work anymore, and the goal which has not been reached.
Yeah.
I mean the final goal.
Yeah.
So and then in a way,
yeah.
So it feels kind of lost, and that's why I'm asking this question in respect to this verse.
Yeah. I think when we're talking in the Bhagavad Gita, when they're talking about the karma yogi, the karma yogi versus the jnani, the one who has knowledge. When they're talking about the karma yogi, or the mumukshu now, I'm viewing as a karma yogi, is one who has now come to knowledge. They're being taught, but they don't have it yet. They don't know. They're not clear. Whereas for the jnani, for that jnani, just I am Ishwara is the reality. Right? For the jnani, for the mumukshu or the karma yogi, they are being taught. They've come to this knowledge, but they're just starting to get it. You know, so that ahankara is still there, but their whole drive of a mumukshu is to gain this knowledge, not to gain a new house or not to go to Swargaloka. They don't care about that anymore. So that person has solely focused on Bhagavan. If that's the case, then who's going to take care of their yoga kshema? Bhagavan says, I will take care of it. You know? While you're seeking, I'll take care of the other things you need. Like that. You're right for your confusion, though. I mean, if it doesn't work for you, just take the jnani, because that's how Shankara did it.
Yeah, because the trust is still lacking, you know?
Yeah. But you know what? The trust is still lacking. Trust is lacking until knowledge is complete. But that doesn't mean that your yogic shame is not being taken care of.
Yeah, of course.
But when you say taking care of, I think I get confused with equals everything will be fine, but that's actually not true. Is that right? I mean, it will be just fine because my attitude is different to what will happen. I mean, I still might get homeless. I mean, it's not that I'm taking... I think that's what I sometimes think. It's like, if I trust enough, I will just held in all, you know, in security by itself. But it's more like I still could be homeless, but I have a different attitude to it.
Totally different attitude.
I would be like, okay, I'm homeless.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's not.
But
like,
the homelessness would be a natural part of your prarabdha.
Oh.
You know, that's what we don't understand. It's like your life, all of our lives, goes through ups and downs and harder times and, you know, better times, but it's our life. And we're the one who are moving in it.
So the yoga and shema is still going on even though she's homeless? I mean, is that...
Well, okay, let me... Yeah. You're never away from the yoga shema, but let me explain this in a different way. And for a samsari who's living kind of within the Vedic Dharma, okay, they are praying to the devatas, the different gods and goddesses, and to Ishwara, doing their rituals. And from their standpoint, they are taking care of their yoga kshema. In other words, I want this, whatever it may be. I want this horse graham cracker. I want this particular thing. And I do rituals, and I pray for it. I evoke the grace of different deities. You know, I do various things and I take actions in order to get that so that I can have that. And then I do prayers and rituals and various things in order to protect that. And so I'm deciding what I want, you know, and then I do what is necessary to get it. And I'm deciding how to protect it and doing what is necessary. So I'm taking care of, as though, my own yoga kshema. I'm taking responsibility for it. Okay, so now, and I'm praying to the Lord to help me also. You know, I'm doing rituals in order to help me to achieve these things. Or I'm asking the Swami. I mean, in India, people go to they all have their teachers, their gurus. They'll go to the guru to get that drishti. You know, please Swamiji, can you bless me so that I can have this? That's very, very common. So they're asking for the blessings of the Lord through the drishti, you know, of the teacher. Very common. So, but they know what they want, you know, they know what their needs are, and they're going after that. Now say a person is a mumukshu, they don't want these things. They don't. I don't want to do rituals to get the Swargaloka. You know, I don't want a new house or this or that. That's not my interest. My interest is, as a mumukshu, my interest is for Ishwar, is for self-knowledge. That's what I must have. They use an example of it for the mumukshu as how a person whose hair is on fire will run toward the lake. You know? It's not like, oh, first let me go have a soda pop over here. You know.
Well, let's talk about it.
Yeah. That's the desire, you know. And so for such a person, or for a person, a jnani, whose only really interest is in Bhagawan, it's not that I have this or that. You know, so that type of kartritvam or doership around procuring my yoga, you know, this yoga, and then protecting the kshema, that's all not there. So then what's going to happen to me then? That fear becomes doubt. What would happen to me then, you know? And then Bhagavan says, you know, don't worry. I take care of that yoga kshema. Because in reality, in terms of the prarabdha karma, I take care of it anyway. Right? You know, we may add a whole bunch of things on it because, you know, the Jones over here have, you know, all of these things that look like, well, if I could have those, I might be happier. If I could add, I see what they have. If I could have that, maybe I'd be. So we add all of these projections onto the prarabdha karma.
Well, see, it's how you define your protection. I mean,
that's right. But what if your protection you've already realized is really shaky? What you consider to be protection is not really protection. I mean, even people who, as their bank account grows bigger and bigger and bigger, they realize all of the things that could happen, you know?
Feeling more insecure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if your prarabdha karma is really, doesn't look so good, you know, you might actually end up being homeless, and you might subjectively not have an experience of yoga kshema.
Well, it depends on what you define as yoga kshema.
Yeah. Right.
You still have a body, you still live on the earth, you know, you still are in an environment.
Kidneys are working. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know. But granted, you do have a different attitude, you know. Because there can be some kind of resistance, yeah, but, you know, when I get the self-knowledge and then the universe will stop changing. I get self-knowledge and then everything will become fine, as though self-knowledge means it's like a blessing, you know, on your situation in the universe. It's a blessing on you, and it's a blessing on the way that you hold your situation in the universe, but the situation in the universe is still, you know, subject to what it is. Mm-hmm. It's not like, I mean, if all of a sudden, what if your prarabdha, say, just imagine your prarabdha karma is going along from birth to death and you're halfway through it and you get knowledge. And just by chance, your prarabdha, which had been kind of rocky at this point, just by chance, the prarabdha shifts and becomes really much, much better. <You know? laughs> And that coming better happens to happen at the same time that you're getting knowledge. And then you can think, knowledge.
You can project it.
Yeah. Knowledge, you know, makes everything, makes the world change. And you know, I just, that's not true. However, the way you are in that world, because, you know, the prarabdha could be going along, you know, and it's rocky, 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 and you get knowledge, and it just continues rocky, rocky, rocky. But the way you're holding it will be different. And the type of maybe response from the world in terms of attitudinal response changes, but just like it whether you have knowledge or not, your attitude changes the way, you know, the face you give to the world is the face it gives back. And so what if the face you give to the world is more relaxed and cheerful, even though rocky, you know?
Yeah.
Then your experience of the rockiness is much different. You know?
But it's also all interrelated, especially when it comes to Purakta Kama. You know, the fact that you're actually gaining knowledge is exactly what might be the initiation for your financial situation to take off too, because they're all connected. It's all connected.
It's all connected, but it's one isn't...
It's not causatively directly.
Yes, it's not, it's not causal. And I think that feeling, causal expectation is that, you know, now that I'm a jnani, I'm special. And so the universe will start...
I won't be harmed.
The universe will start being really wonderful to me.
It might be the opposite, though. One goes up and one goes down. The other goes down.
It's not causal.
Also, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Also, the effects of prior karma are still going on. Something I did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or something that I held for most of my life is still fructifying.
That's absolutely right. And the prarabdha karma is what happened in your last life.
Mm.
That's influencing the entire entire life. But, you know, with knowledge or without knowledge, attitude is amazing. The attitude with which you hold your situation affects the ambiance of the situation so much, you know. Mm. When you have knowledge, there's just more peace, because so much more peace that's going to be present to the situation, because the ananda that you seek isn't touched by the situation, because the self isn't touched by the situation. That makes for a whole different way of holding it, you know?
Also, there's another kind of ananda that comes from where you see how one thing led to the next, and how a certain unfortunate situation that you're going through is the result of something you did before. Just the clarity of seeing how one thing
leads to the next, and the complexity. In fact, Swamiji does those kind of meditations, which I think are really beautiful, where you put yourself, say you have a difficult, for instance, situation with someone, and then you sit facing that person in the meditation, and then you trace back in your own life, in reference to that person, this situation caused this, which caused this, which caused this, that led to this particular point in time, and then you realize that for the other person, this had happened, and this had happened, and this happened, and this happened. It's complex. It led to this point of time, and now here we are creating this moment and this emotion. You know, but you see the complexity, everything that went into, all of the interrelated cause-effect relationships that went into the production of this emotion that is here right now. You know, and you look at the emotion as a product, as something that's actually been created by the complexity of these cause-effect relationships. You know, and then it becomes interesting. Then you can see, you know, you can take an action, you know, in reference to that person, that changes that dynamic, because cause-effect. That's interesting. Attitude. We have a lot of power over attitude.
Mm.
Because it's subjective, you know. It's subtle. Attitude is subtle. This is physical. Do we stop? I'm going to meet with somebody now.
I just wanted to ask one quick question about desire. You know, the svara dvesha thing is so obvious, you know, but at the same time, just even thinking about that desire might not be the driving force. You know, I mean, to totally have this as a living vision, so to speak, living that vision, you know. I'm still... not quite getting that it's really possible to kind of completely step out of that that frame of reference. Like, for example, if I'm hungry, there's a desire, right?
Yeah, but desire is not the problem. And you will have desire. Desire
is
part of...
Where it lands is kind of...
No, not exactly. What they say is, like, desire itself, if you look at the Prarabdha Karma, they say there's three ways of evoking the... initiating the Prarabdha.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those ways is one's coming from one's own desire, like what impels you to do
mm-hmm.
what you do. A lot of times it's coming from your own desire, which is part of the Prarabdha.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be, that's called Swecha, Swa-icha, mm-hmm. one's own desire. In other words, it is Anicca. It's nobody's desire, the creation, you've just found yourself in the situation. The other one is Anyecha, Anya-icha. It comes from another. Somebody wants you to do something. You know, like taking care of your parents for it. They need you. They, it's your responsibility. They pull you into that. You know? And it's their desire, their needs that instigate the action. Or your own desire comes out of your own desire. Or the karmic situation. So the desire itself is really not a problem. That gives energy. But the problem with the desire is that if there's ignorance there, the desired whole desire template is in operation. And the desire template is this. I want this, that's the desire, so that I can be happy. That's the problem. You know? I want this so that I can be happy. I don't want this so that I can be happy.
Mm-hmm.
So my ananda is, my fullness is totally superimposed on the desire. Whereas for jnani, the prarabdha is in operation, so I want this. But I don't have a feeling that, oh, if I don't get it, I'm going to be destroyed. Or I'm going to be so, I want this, but if I don't get it, I'll be so unhappy, you know? So that's where, that's the link that's broken. And that's the link that causes pain. You know, I want this, I want, but you can want something, and if you don't get it, like the helium balloon, oh, I love having this, and if it goes, it goes. It doesn't matter. That's vairagya. And that, the only way you can have vairagya on an absolute level is if you yourself are the source of the ananda. Then it's not going to be taken away. So then you're free. You have vairagya toward everything. I enjoy this while it's here, and if it's not, fine, because it's not the source of my wholeness. I'm not dependent on anything. What if you feel like if I gain, by as a marker of my gaining knowledge, I have no desires? That isn't true. Those kind of notions cause a huge amount of problems, because then you'll be thinking, oh, one's just come, oh God. But say you have a desire and that so that I can be happy comes, then there's some vichara, and, you know, analysis and bringing your knowledge, what you know, to light on that, so that you can still go after that because you have some energy toward it, but you can also be free. That if it, whether it comes or not, is you're fine. That's when you bring in that your knowledge, and you can feel the desire when that. So that I can be happy is an operation.
Yeah.
You can feel how the desire twists you, you know.
Yeah.
Causes some stress and pain and anxiety and worry and samsara. That's our name for it, is samsara.
Yeah, you get caught by it.
Yeah.
It's a catching.
It causes pain, stress, anxiety, all these words.
Self-concern.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of words for that.
We've got the words for them. Yeah. Okay, let's call it a night.
Okay, thank you.
Taylor, hi, Dechen.